Hello, you're very welcome to Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a global investment advisory business that connects investors with relevant investment opportunities. This year, we became the title sponsor of the Ireland Men's and Women's Sevens teams. This podcast will explore the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and what are the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. We're delighted to welcome our guest for today's episode, David Nusafora, the High Performance Director of the Irish Rugby Football Union. David has built quite a resume in rugby. He started his career representing Queensland before going on to play for Australia during their victorious Rugby World Cup campaign in 1991. David moved into a coaching role with the Brumbies, with the highlight being a Super 12 title in 2004. He then moved into a high-performance manager role with the Auckland Blues in New Zealand before becoming the general manager of the Australian Rugby Union's high-performance unit. Since 2014, David has been the high-performance director of the IRFU, which has been an extremely successful period for Irish rugby, but one that has also proven at times extremely challenging. David, you're very welcome. It sounds like that's quite the journey. I'd love to hear a little bit about it in your own words, maybe, and then culminate by telling us what that role in the High Performance Director for the IRFU involves today.
Firstly, thanks, Connor, for having me on the podcast today. I suppose you never really spend a lot of time reflecting on where you've been. I'm always more interested in where I'm going, but I suppose you do need to take a breath sometimes and look back at where you've been, because obviously a lot of what you do going forward is based on your learnings of the past. So it's been a fascinating journey for me. My life in rugby has been long and interesting, challenging, but unbelievably rewarding, and I'm really grateful for that. My playing days finished, I got myself into coaching. I pretty much started coaching straight away. As soon as I finished playing, I was just involved in the local clubs, coaching at that level, and a call really came out of the blue from the Brumbies to ask if I'd be interested in applying for the head coach role down there, which at the time Eddie Jones was the coach, and Eddie was heading off to coach the Wallabies. I ended up getting the job, and it was a learning curve. And you look back on anything that you did a while back and you go, well, would I have done it the same way? And you look back and go, oh, gee, I wouldn't do that again, or I wouldn't do that again. But there's lots of things that I learned during that phase, as I did when I went to New Zealand post the Brumbies. That was a real eye-opener for me, being able to end up being the head coach there of the Blues. I was the first and only Australian that's ever coached one of their Super Rugby sides. And I had a very able assistant coach there, a fellow by the name of Joe Schmidt, who he and I teamed up back then. And, I was lucky that I had someone of Joe's expertise to assist me during that time, because being an Australian working in New Zealand rugby isn't always easy. But that taught me a lot as well. And from there, I was back home to Australia and running the high performance unit for Australian rugby. Again, slightly different role in what my responsibilities entailed. I was more off the field, but my skill set was very much from on the field. And I had to try and mold the role to make sure that I concentrated on what I was good at and got help for what I needed help with in that role. And we had a pretty good time during that phase from 2008, 2012. We were mainly hovering around second in the world. We had a lot of success in our underage programs. We were developing the sevens in Australia at the time, the women's sevens in particular. And then my time came to an end there. I did a bit of coaching in between, just coaching sevens actually. I went back and helped the women's and the men's Australian sevens teams. Went to the World Cup in Russia in 2013 with them as an assistant coach in that area before I came over to Ireland, and been here since 2014. And it's been a really interesting time. I've enjoyed it immensely. as you said, challenging at times, but incredibly rewarding. You know, we've achieved a lot, I feel, but there's still more to do.
No, for sure, absolutely. If we hone in maybe on the Sevens program, which obviously Triton Lake have been sponsors for a relatively short period of time, we feel there's a lot of parallels in the journey that the Triton Lake business has been on. We've both been around for 5 or 6 years, really in earnest. We've been through a growth phase. We're looking more globally for more success and so forth. But maybe talk about how that structure came about existing and being rebooted, for want of a better word, I guess, in the Irish context.
Yeah, certainly rebooted on the men's side. I think that one of the major players for the role of Sevens came back in 2009 when they admitted it as an Olympic sport to commence in Rio in 2016. And that's an absolute honour for the game to be able to be represented on that stage. And that meant that it not only elevated the role of Sevens, but it elevated its role within the game of rugby. And rugby Sevens is a fantastic game for those who want to take the time to get involved in it, because it is the ultimate test of a player. Of your courage, your endurance, of your skills, and you are basically in a position where you will be judged nonstop for 14 minutes because you can't hide anywhere. And the game it has unbelievable consequence, and it's one of the real reasons why, as a game, I think that it's incredibly important to the development of players, because they understand consequence, because everything matters. And, you know, that for me, that revolves a lot around what I believe the philosophy of high performance is, that there has to be consequence and everything matters. And the game just, you know, oozes that. And so from the point of view of developing players, it's fantastic. From the point of view that it actually gives players on the field those learnings I was just referring to, but off the field, you know, once you get to the level where our teams are at now in the World Series, you bring in all the other factors that players learn. They learn about recovery. They learn about traveling, you know, playing tournaments back to back. They travel, economy flights all around the world. It's difficult travel. Sevens is unique that it's a communal living environment where you're living with your teams, other teams you're competing against. They fend for themselves to a large degree on so many things off the field. They play in front of large crowds, which is a great experience for a lot of young players. There's just so many add-ons that the game brings to the growth and development of an individual and a rugby player. And it's not available anywhere else. So we wanted to be a part of it. We wanted to be in it, and we've managed to do that. Get both our teams onto the World Series, and we intend to stay there, and we intend to grow the game because we think it's the basis of growing rugby in Ireland also.
No, very much so. And in terms of, if I think about that, and I'm not sure at what point. I mean, if the Sevens was admitted as an Olympic sport in 2009, at what point was a decision taken that the IRFU were going to take this seriously? Was that before you arrived and you kind of helped them design the structure, or did it all happen around the same time?
The 2013 World Cup in Russia, the Irish women's team did quite well, and they qualified for the World Series the following year. Being 2014 now, I don't think that the there was any vision for the game at that point, but it did make the IRFU sort of sit back and go, well, gee, we've got to deal with this. And I suppose it was more coincidental than anything else that, you know, where I saw the benefits of the game and growing the game, we wanted to maintain the position that the girls had acquired in the World Series. But at the same time, we hadn't had a men's team. So we created that straight away. We did it offer no budget whatsoever, very low cost setup. And we had to compete in the fourth division of Rugby Europe. So, you know, I think our initial tournament was in Bosnia somewhere, and we were playing teams like Iceland and Austria and rugby powerhouses. So the boys did a fantastic job to be able to work their way through those divisions, get into the top division of Rugby Europe, qualify in Hong Kong a couple of years ago for the World Series. And, you know, the story goes on with their qualification for the Tokyo Olympics this year. So it's been quite a rise, but it's taken a lot of time and effort to put together the team around those teams to ensure that we had the ability to enable the players to meet those goals, to be the best they could be. And there's been a lot of people involved in putting that together and making it the program that it is today.
No, absolutely. We touched on it a little bit in terms of the outlook for the future, but maybe explain a little bit how Sevens fits in as a program alongside the men's and women's 15s programs, and also, I guess, as you look forward, what are the goals for the next 3 to 5 years from here?
Yeah, the model that we with the men, I'll start with the men. The model that we have there is that we would identify a group of players that would be basically our core players, our players that are the hub of the team. And we've had a lot of those boys that were in it from going right back to 2014-15 there in Bosnia. They've maintained the base of the team. And then what our strategy is to utilize the team to bring in our academy players that we think would be one, suitable to the game, but secondly, the game would be beneficial to their development. And when we combine those players with the boys that make up the hub of the team, you know, we try and sit with that group for a year or two, and there'll be players coming in and out during that time, some going back into 15s rugby, and getting that balance right for them. We've had a lot of players pass through the system now that have gone on. You know, the notable ones being, you know, Hugo Keenan, who's now playing his 15th or 16th test match.
In a row, right?
Yeah, in a row. Yeah. And we've had other players, Will Connors and a number of other boys, you know, that have progressed through either to that level or certainly up into professional contracts. But we've also had the hub of the boys that maintain the program, and a lot of those boys dominated the side in the Olympics in Tokyo. You know, we're in a position now with our training center out at the National Sports Campus there at the High Performance Center, where all of our high performing teams are based there. So we have the ability there with resources, coaches, support areas such as strength and conditioning or physiotherapy or performance analysis or nutrition or whatever it might be. It's a learning environment that Sevens plays a really important role in, because it offers us a point of difference. It offers us a way to, for the 15s game, sometimes to sit back and actually look at the Sevens game and the way they do things, or some of the things that they learn that the 15s coaches and support staff learn from. So it's really a learning environment in that training facility. For the women, what we have tried to do there is that it's been a mixture of talent transfer, where we've tried to attract a lot of talented athletes from other sports. We have a number of girls who come from the Gaelic sports that have been in the game now. We identified them early on through some talent transfer days. We've had a number of other girls that have just come through the usual rugby pathway that exists. We've put a lot of emphasis and focus into creating an under 18 competition, because our under 18 girls who have been, you know, very successful have competed in the European competitions, and that's been a pathway for us to be able to develop those girls and bring them in at quite a young age into a full-time program, and they are now coming through. a lot of the girls that have been in and out of the program over the years, some of them make it to the highest level within that group. And the ones that don't, there's been a lot of talent transfer girls that have used rugby sevens as the entry point to the game for them. And even if they haven't been successful for a long period, they've learnt rugby and they've moved into the 15s game. And you know, a lot of the players that play international 15s or just club 15s now are girls that entered the game of rugby through sevens, because rugby, for people who are mad rugby lovers, they like the complexity of the game of 15s rugby. They like the intricacies of it, even though a lot of the times they're probably scratching their head trying to work out what happened. But those same things that people like about the game, other people view them as intimidating and a difficult game to learn. And this is where rugby sevens comes into it. It's the simplistic version of the game and has all the basic skills and requirements of the game. It's less cluttered, it's less confusing, and it's a great entry point to the game. So for us, trying to attract other athletes into the game, whether it be in the men's or the women's game, we see it as a version of the game that can help grow rugby full stop. And we see that as the future of being able to really rapidly increase the growth, particularly in the women's game.
And was that just, interestingly, I was just thinking back to the point where you mentioned earlier on about the sevens program in Australia. Was that part of the strategy there to attract people away from Aussie rules? And
yeah, there's a lot of similarities between Australian sport and Irish sport, particularly in rugby. I mean, in Australia, you have direct competition for athletes with the other football codes. It's a very crowded landscape. The similarity here, obviously, are the Gaelic sports, which are massive and ingrained in people's thinking. And you have to learn to compete. You have to learn to be able to say, well, how are we going to get our fair share of the best athletes playing our game? And sevens was handed to us on a platter with the fact that it became an Olympic sport. It was put down there and said, here you go, you've got this fantastic version of your game that's an Olympic sport, and what do you want to do with it? Well, we're going to do lots with it. We're going to grow the game firstly, because once you start growing the game, you're expanding your reach, you're expanding the popularity of the game, you're starting to diversify into the people that are interested in the game, which has all sorts of benefits. But for us to be able to use it to just, grow the game, grow the talent pool, grow the success of the game. So it was a gift.
Okay. And I think if we, we take stock of where we are today, obviously we have two teams on the World Series. We had a men's team that just featured in the Tokyo Olympics. What are the goals? We have a short Olympic cycle, I guess, which makes the short-term goals pretty clear, right? But as you look forward for the next 5 years, where would you like this sevens program to go?
Well, I'd like our program, for me, it serves a number of purposes. It's a flagship for us. The fact that we could qualify the men into the Olympics for the first time, and if you consider what a short time span it's been going to get themselves there, was a pretty remarkable achievement. But if you ask anyone around the team, players, management, whoever, they'll be disappointed with how they went. So the hunger is there and the confidence is there to know that we can do better. So going forward, our aim is to get both our teams to Paris in 2024. We'd like the women and the men to be qualifying, and we'd like them both to be not just qualified but competing for medals. That's our ambition. And I think even with the fact that we qualified for Tokyo in the men's game, that in itself is beneficial, because it just raises awareness, it raises options. It shows what a great sport rugby is full stop, because of its international exposure. And I think to a lot of people who play the Gaelic sports, if they want that challenge to be able to go and play on that sort of a stage, well, then there's that opportunity there that exists for both men and women. So, our push forward will be to have both our teams there, to grow the game, to attract young girls and young boys into the game via rugby by giving them access points that are that are not intimidating, that are easy to follow, and there's the ability there for them to go on and maybe just play sevens, maybe play sevens and 15s, or maybe transition just into 15s. So it's a wonderful opportunity that we've got here.
Okay, great. Changing tack slightly, leadership and leadership skills, right? Talk to us a little bit about the role. I mean, obviously it's hugely important, but as you think about coaches, captains, that kind of thing, communication between all of those layers. And, you know, I'm thinking again of the transferability of some of these skills between elite sports and business, right? When you're looking at it from a rugby context, and I know you have the business experience as well for this, what is it that is are the most important elements of that in terms of coaching, captains, leadership, and so on?
I think that the further up you go in elite sport with coaching, it becomes slightly less about the technical and tactical aspects. It becomes more about the emotional intelligence that people possess to be able to bring a team together, to be able to understand the synergy of how to get the best out of people, how to make sure that people's skill sets complement each other and work together to get the outcomes that you're chasing. Obviously, you know, from a coaching perspective, you have to have a pretty solid level of technical and tactical, but it gets to the point where it actually becomes more important, I think, to be able to understand how you actually get the best out of the people you've got in front of you, and how do you actually mold that into a unit that can bring success.
Okay, makes sense. In terms of the role, I guess, as you look back at the time you've spent in this role, has there been periods of transition or difficult periods that you've had to work through as part of that?
Many. Look, there has been. I mean, it's human nature to not want to change. Change is intimidating. It's a bit scary for people. People get comfortable and they don't like changing because they know what's going to happen next. And if you really want to immerse yourself in high achievement, high performing, whatever you want to call it, you've got to be prepared to put yourself out there. And that takes courage. It takes courage from the athletes, from the coaches, from the administrators. But you've got to be prepared to go there. And to go there, you're going to get pushback because not everyone's going to say, yeah, great idea. Let's totally change and do that. So the strategy of how you move people along with you to make change, I suppose it's a lot about how you explain a vision to someone. It's about how you involve them in the vision, and also thinking about what's in it for them. You know, what do they get out of maybe putting themselves out on a limb at a place they've never been comfortable with? You know, what's the personal gain for them? Are they going to get out of coming for the journey, coming for the ride? And I think if you think about those things and you're thinking about the people who are coming with you, that it's not a journey, it's not a solo journey, it's a journey about a lot of people, you know, as I say, taking risk, putting themselves out there, and understanding how that affects them along the way. So buy in at an early stage because people are clear in what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. And I think once they grasp that, then you're in a position to bring them with you, but at all times, making sure you understand that you're looking after them on that journey, that they've got benefit out of it as well.
Okay, and I guess we haven't used the word, but there's a cultural aspect to it, right? So it's creating a culture of high performance and then working with individuals that buy into it and are happy to exist in that ecosystem. As you look at the performance and you think about high performance generally, what type of analysis or research do you then carry out, I guess, to monitor? Is it extremely rigorous monitoring every aspect of the performance, or how does that side of it work?
Well, you do. I mean, I think living in high performance environments, you have, in this day and age, there's a lot of data. I mean, there's it's about everything. So you do rely on that to a certain point, and understanding what all those things tell you. You know, we're monitoring all sorts of things these days in the game. But at the same time, I think it's also important to understand that high performance environments are unforgiving places, and you know, the difference, the margins between success and failure in at the top level of elite sport are so fine, and you really have to ensure that you are looking at the minutiae, because that probably will be the difference between winning and losing. So, you know, that's where the, you know, data analysis and everything else comes into it, to look at the the small things that can make a difference to you. But I think as far as the athletes and the coaches go, there needs to be an understanding that you exist within a fairly tight parameter, whether you win or you lose, and people that can maintain focus within that parameter without becoming too emotional, that can understand why they performed well or didn't perform as well, or how well the opposition performed. You can't peak and trough to enormous extents in high performance. You've got to maintain a focus on where you're going and not be overly disappointed when you're beaten, because that will happen. And I suppose to remain pragmatic when you win, because you know your next loss is just hiding around the corner, and you've got to maintain your focus on what you're doing and where you're going. So it's a pretty tricky and complicated landscape, high performance.
Sure. Thinking about the business side for a second, what would you say the most transferable skills from that high performance sports environment are in your mind, that can be just as well applied in the performing business world?
I think there's probably more than a couple, but the ones that I would look at, I'd certainly go back and look at the human element. You know, the human element is everything, because most organisations, be it sport or business, are made up of people, and it's about understanding. It's about understanding how you get the best out of those people, and it's about understanding what their skill sets are. But more importantly, you've got to understand what your own skill set is. You know, someone said to me a long time ago, you know, be very clear on what you don't know. And if you understand that, you then have a good appreciation of what you need around you and what you need to build a team. So that's really key. I think the other thing is probably looking at looking at people who are prepared to or comfortable in taking risks, people that are comfortable in putting themselves on the edge, out of their comfort zone, is a really important factor. And I think the other part is, you know, when you're talking about, be it business or sport, you need to be fairly uncompromising, you know, because I would say often that compromise is the enemy of performance. Now, that doesn't mean that you're totally single-minded and you're not going to, you know, learn and take on viewpoints along the way, but it's very easy to be knocked off course in whatever you're doing, be it business, be it sport. And I think once you've got a clear vision of what you're doing and where you're going, you've got to be tough, you've got to be uncompromising to be able to carry something like that out if you want to get to where you're going. And that's... You know, I think that's an important part of business and sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, I know you said you like to look forward and not back most of the time. But if you were to give one piece of advice to a younger David Nusafora, what do you think that might sound like?
Gosh, it's probably a lot. If you asked a few other people, there's probably a lot more. Look, I think that I probably would have backed myself earlier. You know, I think that it took me quite a while to shake off the doubts that I had about, you know, my own ability in whatever it might have been, whether it be in my sport or in my business, and just really, you know, have the confidence to be able to trust. You get one shot at trying to do most things in this life, and I've always been of the opinion, you know, that you don't want to have regrets. You don't want to say, "I wish I had," you know, or "if only I could have." And a lot of that revolves around, you know, don't be scared of failing, you know. And I think that's what deters people from having that confidence. They're more scared of failing than they are of succeeding, and that gets in the way. So, yeah, don't be scared of failure. Failure is actually your friend a lot of the times, because that's where your best learnings come from. And, you know, you'll get criticized, so be it. But I'd rather fail and have been criticized than have not tried at all. So I'd implore young people to think about that.
Think about that and back themselves more, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Very good. Thank you, David. That's a great chat. Really gives myself and the listeners some fascinating insights around leadership, what we can learn from sport and so on. Good luck with everything, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Cheers, Connor. Thank you. And thank Triton Lake for the wonderful support you give us.
Of course.